This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
Are you looking to save 50, 60, even 70% on your phone bill? Well, here's a tip. Broadvoice.com. Hi, it's Brad Staggs of Blaze TV here. Broadvoice offers high-quality phone service for only $8.95 a month. You may ask, how can I save so much money? What's the catch? Well, the secret is the technology. Broadvoice uses VoIP technology that takes analog audio signals from your phone, turns them into digital data, and then transfers them over the internet. This means crystal clear sound and cheaper phone bills. Broadvoice has been ranked in the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 and Inc. 500 as one of the fastest growing private companies in America. Get Broadvoice right now for only $8.95 a month. Keep your existing phone number for free, and Broadvoice will send you their easy plug-in adapter free. All this, and you get unlimited local calling for just $8.95 a month. Plus, for a limited time, Broadvoice will even give you your first month free. Do what we did here at Blaze Radio. Make the switch today at broadvoice.com or call 888-332-8036. 888-332-8036.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to the Freedom Hut. Thank you very much for joining. Good of you to be with me. Let's kick it off today with a Buck Brief, shall we?
You are entering the Blaze Threat Ops Center. This is a secure space. All outside comms are down. Prepare to receive the Buck Brief.
Let's do some DOCX together, document exploitation. Now, this is military and intelligence speak for what you do after you find a bunch of data, information, all sorts of hard drives, hard copy paper, whatever it may be, at the site of some sort of a raid or a strike. Right? Afterwards, you have to go through all of that data, all of that information. You have to engage in document exploitation, DOCX. So let's do that together in a couple of different ways. Let's start with Osama bin Laden. Now, of course, as you know, the raid occurred in 2011. It's been a few years since this happened. And it kicked up a little more controversy recently because of an article written by Seymour Hersh, the same individual who broke the My Lai massacre and also the Abu Ghraib scandal. But some say that now he's jumped the shark. He's gotten kind of old and kooky, and you can't trust him anymore. Some interesting theories, at least, forwarded in that article. And it also brings up at least one point that now is in the news again. And that is, what happened to all the stuff that the SEALs gathered together on site during the Osama bin Laden raid, during the mission which killed him? And they've released some of it. They've released, a few hundred pages, perhaps, in total of this. And this is in response to, well, the public, of course, just wants to know. And the intelligence community is responding to that desire. Interesting, by the way, that they released this now, because part of the Hersh article, of course, was where was all the stuff that they supposedly seized on site? So the timing of this does seem something like a rebuke, whether intended or not, of the Hersh article. Essentially saying, here's the stuff. You say there's no stuff? Here's the stuff. Well, at least some of it. This is a very small percentage of what was said to have been gathered from the bin Laden compound. Now, a lot of it is very mundane stuff. There's some sort of, in some places, incoherent philosophy, letters that bin Laden was writing out about what the strategy should be. In other places, he talks about things that would be of greater importance to us. Where should Al-Qaeda and its affiliate groups be focusing their attacks, and what sort of attacks should they be engaged in? So you get a window into this, but understand that there's already bin Laden's mentality is pretty well understood just based upon the compilations of his writings and public speeches from even pre-9/11 times. Somebody who was very open about this. He was essentially declaring in a letter to the editor that he was going to war with the United States. He would publish this openly and explain why he was going to war. So we know bin Laden's theories and motivations pretty well, but there's more of that in here. What's perhaps more interesting are some of the things that give us a sense of who he was, what he liked, what he was interested in. He, for example, collected a number of conspiracy books, like The Bloodlines of the Illuminati and Secrets of the Federal Reserve. Who knew? A bit of a surprise there. He also liked the collection of self-serving gossip that is published under the byline of Bob Woodward and the sort of Woodward books on various presidencies and what's going on. He liked Noam Chomsky. He had at least one book by the MIT professor of linguistics, though he's known better for being a critic of U.S. foreign policy. So he had a Noam Chomsky book. And really, this is obvious. I would have expected this because Chomsky is the only American writer bin Laden could find who hates America more than al-Qaeda does. So, of course, you'll have Chomsky on the bookshelf. That makes perfect sense. They found porn, I would assume, on his computer, although maybe he was kicking it old school with the pages of Playboy. I don't know. They found some form of pornography. They're not telling us what it was, or certainly they're not sharing it. But it's always an interesting point that these jihadists, these very imperious and supposedly pious holy warriors, really have a thing for porn, going to the strip club. And then now they want their women to dress as beekeepers and be second class. Not to call them second class citizens would be to give them too much credit, to treat them as essentially somewhere between a human being and property. Right. They want them to be invisible to the outside world. The man has full control over the domain. They also, of course, in many cases, believe in polygamy, and they do all this stuff. And then on the flip side, though, we find out that those with access are quite fond of pornography and other sort of erotic entertainments, we could call it, you know, whether it's strip clubs or somewhere else. So bin Laden, no different in that respect, no different than we've seen with many, many other jihadis. Now, of course, the debate that's breaking out is, well, how operational was bin Laden really at this time? Or rather, how much operational control, I should say. He wasn't an operative himself. But how much was he really involved in the attack planning and the day-to-day of this organization, al-Qaeda, the base, which he founded? And it seems pretty clear that based upon the fact that he didn't have an internet connection, that he obviously wasn't really that involved, but he seemed to be at least sharing his words of bin Laden-esque wisdom with the various leaders of different affiliates and cells around the world, and had not given up on the notion of attacking America. In fact, believed that attacking America was, and I was able to read through a number of these released documents last night, attacking America was more important than some of the other focuses of al-Qaeda. Also gives you the impression that al-Qaeda was surprised by the Arab Spring, didn't see that coming, which you would think that they would at least have some sense of it. So maybe our government analysts can feel better about the fact that we also missed it because al-Qaeda didn't really know. He points out that Egypt is really the most important country in that whole phenomenon, which is true. That's pretty conventional wisdom. And there are some other places as well where bin Laden gives us a bit of his political analysis, and it's not stuff that you wouldn't expect, given his perspective and his desire to wage war against America and to essentially cast off the yoke of the unbelievers, of the infidels. So that's the docx there, and I'll be continuing to look through and read through his various pronouncements and statements and all the rest of it and see what else he has on his bookshelf. I might have to pick up a copy of The Bloodlines of the Illuminati. It sounds spooky. And Secrets of the Federal Reserve. I think I already have that one. So there's that document exploitation. Now there's another one, another docx that we should talk about for just a minute here. And this is, of course, with our press, not going to get as much information. The bin Laden stuff is mostly just historical context, and it's worthwhile background information for how the former, the now deceased leader of the most virulent and dangerous jihadist organization in the world, how he thought, what he liked to read, what his interests were. But it hasn't changed that much. You know, Zawahiri has many of the same beliefs and many of the same positions and strategies as bin Laden. And more importantly than that, the Islamic State now overshadows al-Qaeda as what seems to be a rapidly growing and metastasizing threat. But there's another point of docx, of document exploitation, that I think would be worth taking a minute here. That has to do with Hillary. Now, I'm not saying that we're equating in any way Hillary and bin Laden. I'm not crazy, but I'm just saying that there are more documents out. We have the bin Laden documents that have been released, and we have more Hillary documents that have been released. So I figured under the DocX headline, we could cover both of them. And now what Hillary shows us, we don't get a sense of what her favorite books are, although I'm sure she has lots of books about herself on the bookshelf that she didn't write. But, you know, why not? Hillary's emails have now been, or some of them, I should say, some small portion of them have been released. And already you can start to see a picture of, well, you can start to get the early indications of why there were so many concerns about Hillary's emails getting out there for people to read and see all, by themselves and come to their own conclusions about. For example, on Benghazi. Yeah, that's still a thing, remember? They don't want us to talk about Benghazi anymore. I've actually been asked on live television, is Benghazi, Buck, you're a conservative commentator. I guess that's what I would call myself, although I don't like labels. Is Benghazi something that really might be a problem for Hillary? I'm like, well, I don't think it's going to prevent her from becoming possibly the president, because unfortunately enough Americans are fooled or don't pay attention. But it should be a problem. It probably will be something of an issue, even though they think that they've put this all away. But it all depends on how much of the data, how much of the document exploitation we're allowed to do based upon the documents that we have. Here's what we have on Benghazi. This via the New York Times. No right-wing rag, to be sure. It's about Benghazi and Hillary speaking to Sidney Blumenthal, who, as we know, is a... People are using very colorful descriptions, so I should come up with a sort of new one. People are calling him a hatchet man, a political operative, a, you know, sort of prince of the dark arts, you know, all these sort of engaged in skullduggery and cloak and dagger behind the scenes. I mean, the guy's just a political hack, right? He just goes out there. He's essentially a highly paid PR guy. Goes out there and spins whatever he needs to for the Clintons. But on Benghazi, somehow this guy, who, as we know, is freelancing for Hillary in Libya, even though the Obama administration said, you can't hire this guy, he's sketchy. So he just went out there, did his own thing, was getting paid by the Clinton Foundation and trying to drum up business in Libya, by the way. He was able to figure out right away, based on these emails that we've now seen, exactly what happened at the annex, at the special mission compound in Benghazi on September 11, 2012. He was able to figure it out within 48 hours. And he sent that information to Hillary, and she received it and distributed it. And yet, somehow, anyway, Susan Rice is going out on the Sunday show saying, oh, it was a protest. It went violent. We don't really know exactly what happened. This is from that email chain, or from the New York Times describing the email chain. The next day, Blumenthal sent Mrs. Clinton a more thorough account of what had occurred. Citing sensitive sources in Libya, the memo provided extensive detail about the episode, saying that the siege had been set off by members of Ansar al-Sharia, the Libyan terrorist group. Those militants had ties to al-Qaeda, had planned the attacks for a month, and had used a nearby protest as cover for the siege. We should get this around ASAP, Mrs. Clinton responded in an email to one of her senior aides. Will do, he responded. New York Times writes, next sentence. That information contradicted the Obama administration's narrative at the time about what spawned the attacks. In early October, in an email exchange before Mr. Obama was reelected, Sidney Blumenthal forwarded Mrs. Clinton an article on a left-leaning website. The article cautioned that Republicans would try to exploit the attacks as a Jimmy Carter strategy and use them to paint Mr. Obama as weak on terrorism. Clinton forwarded the email to Sullivan saying, be sure Ben knows they need to be ready for this line of attack. The whole narrative that people like me have been saying, and many of you as well, from the beginning, that they slowed down the machinery. They tried to do whatever they could to obfuscate, to create a smokescreen on Benghazi because it looked terrible for Obama, whose whole reelection campaign was Mitt Romney's a mean rich guy. And oh, by the way, I killed Osama bin Laden. That's all that he had to offer. They had to make this thing look more complicated and convoluted than it was. They had to sort of take the punch out of the Benghazi attack. They knew they were lying to us. Hillary was part of that lie. Now it's just a question whether the American people actually hold her accountable for it. Back in a minute.
888-900-3393.
You're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Are you looking to save 50, 60, even 70% on your phone bill? Well, here's a tip. Broadvoice.com. Hi, it's Brad Staggs of Blaze TV here. Broadvoice offers high-quality phone service for only $8.95 a month. You may ask, how can I save so much money? What's the catch? Well, the secret is the technology. Broadvoice uses VoIP technology that takes analog audio signals from your phone, turns them into digital data, and then transfers them over the internet. This means crystal clear sound and cheaper phone bills. Broadvoice has been ranked in the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 and Inc. 500 as one of the fastest-growing private companies in America. Get Broadvoice right now for only $8.95 a month. Keep your existing phone number for free, and Broadvoice will send you their easy plug-in adapter free. All this, and you get unlimited local calling for just $8.95 a month. Plus, for a limited time, Broadvoice will even give you your first month free. Do what we did here at Blaze Radio. Make the switch today at broadvoice.com or call 888-332-8036. 888-332-8036.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at theblaze.com.
We're just discussing the Bin Laden document exploitation. Only a small percentage of those documents released, but we're getting a broader picture of, you know, what Osama liked, what he was reading, what he was interested in, what he was thinking. And certainly that's a worthwhile endeavor if we're going to understand al-Qaeda, if we're going to understand the mindset of the enemy. However, the enemy is still very much on the march, and in the form of the Islamic State, they are much more aggressive and on the offensive than it seems the U.S. government at this point is willing to admit, or at least the spin masters out there who are always trying to find some way to tell us that this is a temporary setback or this is no big deal. This is nothing to worry about. No, it is, in fact, something we should worry about. It is deeply concerning. And a lot of American blood was spilled to defend Ramadi years ago, and here we are now, Iraqi soldiers running from the battlefield. It is very troubling indeed. Our whole strategy, if you can call it that, in the Middle East, well, in against the Islamic State, I should say, involves letting others do the fighting. Now, this is great. This makes a lot of sense. This will make people very happy until you realize that what happens if the others can't win? They're not us. They're not the United States. They're not even our closest allies. They're not going to be able to win necessarily. And so then what? Then what's the strategy? On the Iraqi side of the equation, remember, the Iraq-Syria corridor is now where the Islamic State is operating. We're sending missiles, anti-tank missiles, by the thousands to the Iraqi government because we need to help them find a way to counter VBIEDs, vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, essentially a car filled with explosives. See, the problem with a car filled with explosives, if it has enough explosives in it, is that even if you manage to stop it at a checkpoint, it obliterates the checkpoint, and there have to be soldiers at that checkpoint. Even if you have blast walls up and you have jersey barriers and you have other things in place to try to prevent the VBIED from going inside your encampment, in which case, of course, you could have a catastrophic attack that kills everybody. Even if you stop it, the explosion, the concussive force, the shrapnel is enough to cause casualties and destruction. And enough of these things used in concert can be a game changer weapon for the insurgents against the Iraqi forces. So we're sending them anti-tank missiles. The idea here being, well, they can use those to blow up the bomb before they can blow it up close enough to their defenses to do a lot of damage. In many cases, these aren't just VBIEDs, they're SVBIEDs. They're suicide car bombs. And in some cases, they are filled with hundreds of pounds of explosives. Those of you, and I know many of you are former military, those of you who have set off some C4 during training, just a small clump of it, have a sense of what that does. Once you start packing a car with hundreds of pounds of TNT or whatever they've got, it's going to blow big, and it's going to create an enormous hole in your defenses. And this is what we're trying to help the Iraqis now deal with, because they don't have an answer to this. And we're also putting restrictions on who we'll provide air cover to, by the way, because we don't want to be the Shia militia's air force, because when people figure out that the Shia militias don't play very nice and engage in human rights violations and even atrocities in some cases, so far, we're told, those have been limited. But just give it time. We don't want to be the ones providing air cover, direct assistance to that effort. So we can only help the Iraqi government forces. But the most effective forces are, in fact, the Shia militias. This is the situation in which we find ourselves now, or in which the Obama administration has placed us. On the Syrian side of the equation, the ancient Roman city of Palmyra, which became in the first century A.D., became a very sort of wealthy oasis trading center and a place where many of the caravans would transit through. That is now under the control of the Islamic State, as well as some of the resources and other real-time strategic assets that brings into play. And there's also a infamous detention facility there that, of course, is going to have some crazy jihadis in it, so you let them go. Assad's forces have backed off of this. This isn't a victory against other insurgent groups. This isn't a victory against the Free Syrian Army. This is a victory against Assad's forces, and Damascus is growing ever closer. We keep assuming that Assad can hold out indefinitely against the Islamic State. What if he can't? What if they actually take control of the whole country? That's one thought. The other is that these ancient Roman ruins, they're going to be gone, because the Islamic State hates art, beauty, history, all the things that you and I celebrate.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
So I've mentioned to you before about what China is up to. They are building out floating military bases by using a reef, maybe just sticks up out of the water a little bit, a tiny piece of land out in the South China Sea, and using dredging technology and island building, they create a more substantial platform for the projection of military power. They are literally building islands 600 miles from the Chinese coast out in the sea. From there, they can create airstrips, submarine bases, naval bases, you name it. Whatever they need, they can put there, at least depending on how large they can make this island. But if you go and you see the footage now of what they're doing, there's a really serious effort underway to turn some of these islands, like the Spratlys and others, into these bases from which the Chinese can, of course, project military force well beyond their borders. Now, of course, their position on this is, okay, America, yeah, because Guam is really contiguous U.S. territory. Hawaii is contiguous U.S. territory. I mean, yeah, they point out that, okay, we do this, but we don't do it, at least we don't do it now, with disputed land, because there are other countries that claim the rights to these parcels of dirt that or coral that stick up out of the ocean, because of the resource rights that may come with them as well, meaning the mineral rights and perhaps fishing rights and other things around these islands for whoever is the rightful owner, however that can be decided. Usually this is the sort of thing that would go through an arbitration and perhaps some international body. Chinese are like, no, we're just going to take it. Thanks. And there are already some tense moments occurring between U.S. overflights, surveillance flights, trying to get a sense of what's going on these islands and the Chinese. They are using a PA system, for example, or not PA system, rather. They're using radio to tell U.S. planes in the area that this is the Chinese Navy. This is the Chinese Navy. Please go away to avoid misunderstanding. So they're basically telling any flights the U.S. has. Remember, this is not over the Chinese mainland. This is not even over what's recognized as Chinese territory. They're just saying, back off. Huh? Well, that's their position. You see, there's a recognition that the Chinese have that it's not about going big and going all in right away. You turn up the temperature slowly. You engage in just enough aggressive behavior to get what you want without having a real counter response or a real counteraction. That this is a way that you can essentially keep pushing out your power and your borders without having to worry about anyone really standing up and punching the bully in the nose, right? This isn't the bully taking all of your lunch money. It's saying, just give me a bite of your sandwich. Today it's a bite of your sandwich. Tomorrow it's half the sandwich. Then they're taking the little cookies that mom wrapped up for you in some foil so you'd have a little sweet something. Then all of a sudden your Nestle Quick is up for grabs. What's up with that? You're going to take my Nestle Quick? I don't think so. Well, maybe, if you've been giving up everything else. I used to love Nestle Quick. So this is what's happening with the Chinese. This is a real strategic threat. This is a real issue for us because our whole policy is that we have these other countries that act as barriers to Chinese expansionism. And there is something of a zero sum happening here, right? I mean, we don't want to go all bellicose and crazy, but the Chinese are a regional power and they want to be a hemispheric power. And they want to at least push out as far into the Pacific as they possibly can. As we know, they're resource hunting all over the world. They're planting their flag literally at the Arctic, and they're trying to do whatever they can to expand their resource portfolio, if you want to call it that, their military and hard power footprint. And who's going to stop them, really? Who's going to stand in the way? It's not this administration. We're not going to do anything about it. I'm not saying we should go military, but are we even going to make any noise? Are we going to try to come up with some sort of a counter strategy? No. Just going to sit here and suffer in silence. While this is happening, while China is building bases in the middle of the South China Sea and telling our planes, you better not come too close. While that's all happening, President Obama's giving a speech at the graduation of the Coast Guard Academy. He's focusing on the real threats. The real threats, my friends, are not the Islamic State. It's not China's expansionism and saber rattling and intimidation of its neighbors. It's not cyber attacks. It's not an EMP. It's none of that. Don't you guys get it? The real threat is climate change. Play clip two. Do we have
this is not
two?
Just a problem for countries on the coasts or for certain regions of the world. Climate change will impact every country on the planet. No nation is immune. So I'm here today to say that climate change constitutes a serious threat to global security, an immediate risk to our national security. And make no mistake, it will impact how our military defends our country. And so we need to act, and we need to act now.
I don't even know what to say. I don't know how somebody could just be so disconnected from reality. I mean, to say something, I don't know how else to describe it, to say something so stupid. Climate change is going to, what? Because the weather is going to be changing? I know climate is different than weather. Well, weather is the result of climate, and climate is just aggregate weather over a long period of time. I mean, give me a break. That's going to change. That's a national security threat to us. Well, I mean, if we have hotter hots and wetter wets than the other garbage that they say, so will other countries. Okay. And we're better positioned to deal with it than they are. This is a national security. He's talking about this at the Coast Guard Academy. And this isn't something else that's thrown in there. You know, this is the equivalent of Obama essentially saying the biggest threat we face. And if you are a climate change alarmist, you have to believe this because you think the planet is dying. Therefore, the biggest threat we face is climate change, bar none. It's not a nuclear exchange with some crazy jihadist country. It's not a land war somewhere with China. It's none of that. It's climate change. I don't even know where to begin. I don't even know what to say. This is the commander-in-chief, the most powerful individual in the world, and he's giving a speech to those who will be serving in our Coast Guard about how climate change is a thing we really need to be scared of. He's telling adults to be afraid of the weather. Because it's coming for you, man. The weather, man, it's going to be, ooh, you're going to get caught out there without an umbrella. And it's all going to be over. This is insane. But he doesn't stop there. He actually goes on to say that it would be a dereliction of duty not to address climate change. Play clip three.
When you're on deck, standing your watch, you stay vigilant. You plan for every contingency. And if you see storm clouds gathering or dangerous shoals ahead, you don't sit back and do nothing. You take action to protect your ship, to keep your crew safe. Anything less is negligence. It is a dereliction of duty. And so, too, with climate change.
I think that's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard in my life. I actually think you could put that. I'm not sure a more ridiculous, inane, stupid thing has been said by a politician in my memory. It'd be very hard to come up with one. You're telling the Coast Guard it would be a dereliction of duty if they don't tackle climate change? Does he not? What are they? They're supposed to, oh, yes, stop illegal immigration into the country via waterways. They're supposed to stop drug smuggling. They're supposed to protect our shores, right? Well, what are they going to do with climate change? When they're going to take shorter showers? I mean, is he serious? Apparently he's serious. This is a prepared speech at the Coast Guard Academy. He knows he's being taped. He knows this is a policy opportunity for him, right? People are going to pay attention to this. It would be dereliction of duty for the Coast Guard not to take the threat of climate change seriously. It's hard to think of where to even begin here. Given all the threats we face, I just told you about what's going on with China. No response, administration. We're not doing anything. We're not making any noise about this. The whole pivot to Asia is a joke, just like the Russian reset was a joke. They just come up with a clever, pithy name for some foreign policy initiative, and then all of a sudden we're supposed to believe that it's actually happened. It hasn't happened. Where the Islamic State isn't burning itself out, it's a fire that is burning and expanding. But policy there is to sort of just wait and see. That's the real choice the Obama administration has made, by the way, is just keep it from becoming a total disaster and hand it off to the next presidency. Democrat or Republican, whatever, at least it won't be on Obama's watch that we end up having to deal with this. That's another worthy question in itself. When is the carnage too much? When are there too many rapes? When is it too horrific? When do we recognize that this complete destruction of a society and of millions of people's lives will have impact around the world as well as just in the region? But I guess we're not there yet. But here's the president. Once again, the president of the United States saying that climate change is something that the Coast Guard has to be worried about. I want an explanation of how the Coast Guard's supposed to be worried about climate change. What, because the tide's going to be a little higher, their boats can float. Because it's going to be a little rougher seas sometimes, I think they'll handle it just fine. But really, ultimately, this is just the president once again ignoring what his real duty is, which is to speak to these Coast Guard graduates and cheer them on and thank them for their service and make it all about Obama. Because, you know, he's a genius and he thinks that climate change is so scary, so he just wants to make sure everybody knows that. It's a joke.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network. Phone the Sexton Hotline, 888-900-3393.
Team Buck, as the lady said, the broad voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Light them up, let's talk, whatever you want, whatever you got, let's do it. Some of you may want to weigh in on this topic. I wasn't planning about talking about this today, but I just can't help myself, so I have to just excuse me on that one. Because I always say kindness is your first obligation, our first obligation. I try to avoid ever being mean. And so when someone is having a send-off or something, I don't want to rain on the parade. But I think in this case, because I'm such a lone voice on the issue, it doesn't really matter because everyone else is like, oh my gosh, how are we going to survive without David Letterman doing the late night show? Oh no! I mean, really. I will be honest with you. I have not been an avid watcher, obviously, of the show. I can never even remember which one's the Tonight Show and which one's the Late Show, and I don't really care. I do know that I've seen more than one time David Letterman on air act in a way that I thought was snide and nasty and partisan and gross. And I've never thought he was funny. Now, people tell me that he, and people that I trust and who I think have good judgment on these matters, will say that, you know, he used to be funny. And then he got kind of unfunny, and then he got nasty, and then people said, well, then he got a little nicer again. Okay, I don't know. I haven't been watching this guy for the whatever, however many decades he's been on television doing all this stuff. But the absolute, just the sheer amount of people, not just that are sort of, oh, it's a shame that he's like this, oh, what are we going to do without David Letterman? Am I the only one who thinks he's just not funny? I'm the first one to say, I think John Oliver, for example, who I'm sure would disagree with me on a vast majority of things, if he met me, would make fun of my hair and wouldn't like me very much, although I'm pretty charming sometimes. Whatever. I'm the first one to say his show is great and really funny. I disagree with some of the messaging, of course, but he's really funny. And yet with David Letterman, I like old school. I like Wedding Crashers. I'm into all kinds of stuff that would be funny. I like the classics, Ghostbusters. David Letterman's just not funny is what I'm trying to say. I don't understand this. Why do I miss this? I'm convinced, and this is my theory for you, and many of you will disagree with me. I know. I'm sure there are a lot of Letterman watchers in the audience. And I'm not going to go into whether he's a nice guy or not or whatever. I don't know him. I mean, I know stories about him, but I don't know him. But that show, I think, is just sort of it's just all a legacy business, a legacy organization, right? It has a sort of cachet, and it's quite a platform, and it has broadcast TV behind it, and it's storied and has a history. And I think that often breeds laziness, particularly in media. And I think that show's been lazy. I've tuned in before to watch it. The top 10 lists stink most of the time. Sometimes they're okay. That's one of the only parts of the show that I don't think is just garbage. And I just don't understand. So let me know. If you think I'm wrong, I want to know. You tell me if you think Letterman's funny. I feel like I'm the only person who's just like, this guy's just not funny. He's not funny. Why is everyone, I'm reading here, people that I, you know, that I like. Oh, you got Elizabeth Banks. He hasn't said a word and I'm crying. Thanks, Dave. I mean, I like her thing with the singing movie. I'm probably going to go see that soon. Yeah, that's right. I like it. Why do these people think he's so funny? All these different comedians, Conan O'Brien. Well, Conan has. I understand there's sort of a respect. You have to pay homage to Dave if you're in the business, right? But the rest of the people I see on Twitter, there's so much about this. I just think this is a construct, and I know this is outside of our usual, you know, talking about more important things. This is totally frivolous, except that there's a tremendous amount of media coverage of this, right? So other things, you know, China building up bases in the middle of the South China Sea, not getting any attention or interest. But David Letterman's live show is like, oh, my gosh. Look, I hate to say it. I just think David Letterman is the Bruce Springsteen of late night comedy, which is just you're told to like him. And so people just like him without ever thinking about whether they really like him. It just sort of is. I'd even put maybe you could say he's the Bob Dylan of late night comedy. Yeah, I said it. Who listens? When was the last time you walked into somebody's room or you heard somebody in a car and they're blasting Bob Dylan? Never. And yet people go, oh, Bob Dylan, America's poet, like the lyricist extraordinaire. Give me a break. You just sold on this bill of nonsense. So I'm just putting it out there. I just couldn't hold my tongue anymore. He's the guy's worth a ton of money. He's had an amazing career. Everything is great for him. Well, not everything's great for him. Of course, people have their troubles. But I just don't think he's funny. And I feel weird being the only person that I know of who's willing to come out and just say, at least for a decade that I've known of him, he's not funny.
Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, welcome to Hour 2. Thanks for staying with me. Welcome if you're just joining. 888-900-3393 is the number on the Broad Voice. If you have any thoughts on Letterman or Osama bin Laden or Hillary and Benghazi or whatever, by all means do call in. It would be good to hear from you. I'm happy to tell you that from what I see on Twitter, I am not the only one who doesn't find Letterman funny. And I just feel like it's sometimes you just got to speak truth to power, my friends. It's just not funny. I wish I could say that I love comedy. I wish I could say that I have been excitedly watching for years. It's also interesting. Well, I won't get into what people say about, you know, I know people who've worked with him and whatever. Fine. Also, we can't use a clip, of course, from Letterman's show because his show is famously very litigious about using anything from it. Even if you use a quick clip to say, oh, look at this funny thing you said last night. You know, oh, no. Lawsuit. Which I don't like those people. You know, I'll be honest with you. I was really taken aback even back in the old Napster days when Metallica, the multi-millionaires of Metallica were leading the charge against not just, hey, come on, Napster, you got to stop, but like, let's go out and sue a bunch of 12-year-olds for downloading my music. And some grandmothers who don't know who's downloading the music. Maybe it's a 12-year-old, but they'll be held financially responsible and they'll get some ridiculous fine that would bankrupt them and they'd never be able to pay in a million years anyway. That's a really constructive way to do things. Come on, Lars, whatever your name is from Metallica, is weak. That was the weak sauce. I find people who do things like that very, I think that tells you a lot. I think that places that are hyper litigious about protecting, you know, there's protect your intellectual property and there's just being a jerk. And I think that the moment you get into that other category, we should take note of that. And it's really, you got to get special permission, very careful about using anything from the David Letterman show ever. Oh, gosh. Heaven forbid somebody share their top 10 list or something and comment on it. But that's, I suppose, for our purposes, all we have to talk about with the Letterman thing. I just don't get it, though. So much attention paid to this. Every website I go to is, oh, the last show of Letterman. It's just not funny. I stand by my decision here to tell you that it's just not funny. All right, one thing on the climate change, a sort of corollary to the climate change discussion we were having just a few minutes ago, I think is worth pointing out. Occasionally, I dabble. Actually, it's not occasional. I'll tell you how I do it. I have one of my browsers is sort of my linked up with all the sites that I like to go to, that I like to see, and you know, check out. And I got, you know, got the Blaze, Wall Street Journal, Drudge, New York Times. I know, got to read the other side too. I got all these different sites on there. BuckSexton.com, obviously, because it's amazing. And on another browser, just to sort of keep things separate, it's almost like I'm switching hats or I'm changing, you know, I'm changing outfits or something. I have all the left-wing sites that I like to go to. One of the ones that I go to, and it's good to go to The Nation because it's like, oh, you know, I thought maybe I was being a little harsh about how there are a bunch of commies in America, but no, it turns out, in fact, there are commies who are writing for what are supposedly intellectual and highbrow magazines and publications. Oh, who knew? Good to keep that front and center in the mind when talking about progressives and statists and their policies. So there's that. Vox is one of them, though. I occasionally go to Vox. They're really into charts and graphs and things, right? It's Ezra Klein is one of the big people over at Vox. And they had this piece that I thought was interesting on the things that they have learned from covering healthcare. So they're not healthcare experts, but they're people who cover healthcare. And I like this piece because not for the reasons that they necessarily said, although there is some wisdom in here. Things like restrictive diets do not work. Like, I'm just not going to eat that much. It's not going to. Changing what you eat, making small shifts and changes to things, that over time is feasible. That actually can work. But the idea that you're just going to say, well, I'm only going to eat 1,500 calories a day, it's just not going to work. And if it does work, you're kind of miserable and hungry forever. So do you really want to do that? I'm trying to remember what his specific background was. Oh, this is a great comment. A guy told me this when I was in Iraq. And I think he was Marine Recon and had since been put into other government service. And he said to me once, I don't trust any guy over 35 with a six pack, which I always really liked. I was like, yeah, that's right. So at some point, you got to just start eating burgers and living life. You know, it's not all about how you look on the beach without a shirt on. So I don't know. He said he didn't trust any guy over 35 with a six pack. I always thought that was really funny. But there's this study that they put here on this. So anyway, that was the diet thing, which is true. They have all these different things they've learned. Using healthcare is a dangerous proposition, or not dangerous, but it has a risk. Like every time you go to the doctor and you do a procedure, understand that there's a risk involved in that. That's pretty straightforward and obvious, I think. And then there are some others. Be wary of doctors prescribing antibiotics. This is also an interesting point because we've become very sort of pill happy as a culture. Everyone wants a pill. You go to the doctor, you got a sore throat, you know, he gives you a Z-Pak, a Zithromax, or he gives you some sort of, you know, I don't know, erythromycin or some antibiotic. I don't think they give you that for it, but they give you some. I'm allergic to penicillin, so I get all the weird drugs when I go in there. So they give you this stuff, and you think, oh, well, this will make me better. Well, unless you have a bacterial infection, an antibacterial agent's not going to actually help you, and it can kill the good flora, as I believe it's referred to gently, in your intestines, like, whoo, do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, like little flowers growing in your intestines. It's not really what it is. It's bacteria, but the flora of your intestines, the various good bacteria, the antibiotics can kill that off, and then all of a sudden you don't have – immunity is mostly in your GI tract, which they don't teach you in school for some reason, and they absolutely should. I only learned that much later on, and I took anatomy class when I was younger and everything, but they don't tell you that most of your white blood cells and all that is tied to your gastrointestinal tract. So antibiotics should not be used as sort of, you know, it's not a multivitamin. It's not just, oh, I'm just going to take my antibiotics. Oh, by the way, multivitamins also will fit into the thing I'm about to talk about, which is some people say they're great for you and they're going to make you live a long, happy life. Some people say they give you cancer. Who's right? I don't know. It depends on which study you point to. And on this climate change debate, and this is, I'm just bringing this all full circle now, because that's how I roll. There is this idea that keep coming back to this, that the science is settled, the debate is over. And this is what they say to you. And that is inherently, you don't have to be a scientist. I don't care what, you know, organization of climatologists or whatever comes together and yells at people saying, they love to do this. You know, you're not a scientist, you can't understand. Well, I don't have to be a scientist. This is sort of like when you're investing in a company, right? I don't have to understand how a company makes, I don't know, the latest and greatest cellular phone, to know that if the CEO has a history of lying and they can't actually produce the results they say they're going to produce, that it's not a good investment. I don't have to be a cell phone expert to know that this is not something that I buy into. I don't believe it, right? Well, with the climate change experts and the climatologists and the rest of this sort of industry. And remember, the question you're asking them when you say, well, do you believe in climate change, Mr. Climatologist Scientist, is what you do really important and should you get paid a lot for it and travel the world talking about it? Or is it kind of like, I don't know, a geologist with a less impressive degree? And you're asking them that question. You wonder what they're going to say to you. I think it's pretty straightforward, right? If you ask me, Buck, are you spreading freedom and trying to get the word out there to help save this country and preserve liberty and let people have fun while we're doing all that and bring together a community of amazing individuals from across the country and, in fact, in some cases around the world? Or are you just sitting at a microphone and, like, talking into it? I can tell you I would come down pretty strongly on one side of that issue. And just as when you ask climatologists, now, I think I'm being honest, climatologists are being dishonest, but the point here is that, you know, you're asking somebody who benefits dramatically in their own psyche as well as professionally a question of whether they're important or not, or whether what they do is important is an even better way to put it. And I guess that's all tied in together. So they tell you the science is settled, which is just an unscientific, in fact, an anti-scientific proposition in the first place, right? The science is settled. Science is never settled. Science is in constant flux. And I know I've gone all over the place here, but on this Vox piece, which again, Vox, don't go there. You'll be like, oh, what is this? Oh my gosh, they hate America. Yes, but they do some interesting charts and graphs. And they have a listing of health studies. It's wine, tomatoes, tea, milk, eggs, corn, coffee, butter, beef, all these different foods. And they break it down into, points on a graph. Does the study suggest that this prevents cancer or causes cancer? And you look at this and it's amazing. They have here, they have, you know, six studies that say that wine prevents cancer. Three studies say wine gives you cancer. You've got two studies that say beef prevents cancer. You've got seven ridiculous studies that say that beef gives you cancer. And you can do this with all of these. Well, this is a pretty important scientific question, isn't it? Does something you are eating kill you or not? And there are real scientists who are doing real studies who give you different answers. So what I would point to, or what I'm trying to get to here, is if the science isn't settled on eggs, that doesn't mean that, well, we can't figure out the answer, so we should stop asking, we should stop talking, we should stop learning. Of course not. But if the science isn't settled on whether eggs will save your life or end your life, don't you think that maybe there's room for whether a decoupled nonlinear chaos system, which is what climate is described by the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, isn't it fair to say that maybe there's more discussion that should be had about this and what the policies are that will do as a result of this? And isn't that don't we think that there should be room for discussion? Isn't it uncomfortable that there's this sort of totalitarian and fascistic impulse from the left to just try to make this an issue of orthodoxy? And what you see is that for them, the synapses of the brain that look for meaning and truth that many other Americans have filled with God, Christianity, Judaism, whatever their faith tradition may be. As I've said to you before, those who believe they are too smart for religion have turned climate change into their religion. And so that's why it doesn't give way to argument. It cannot be challenged. It cannot be discussed. And they will hunt down heretics and do harm to them. In this case, at least now, our careers and reputations. But for asking questions. You don't have to be a climatologist to know that if science can't tell you if tomatoes are going to extend your life or give you tumors, maybe they're not totally sure about what the global aggregate average temperature will be in 100 years. Just maybe. That's possible. I would say it's certain, but at least we have to leave open that it's possible. Don't we? Not the President Obama. He says the science is settled. All right, Team Buck. Got more coming. 888-900-3393. I'll be back in just a minute.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level. Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, team, the Broad Voice lines are open and waiting for you. 888-900-3393. Quick note, tomorrow I'm in for Glenn Beck from 9 to 12 Eastern Time on Radio Coast to Coast. You can listen on the Blaze Radio, so just go to theblaze.com/radio. But I'll be in for Glenn for 3 hours tomorrow. Looking forward to it, and we will be talking. Let's bring in our friend here, Rob from New Jersey. Rob, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon, Buck. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Enjoying your show. Actually, dedicating about an hour of time to your show and pulling back from Rush a little bit, although I love the Godfather of Radio.
I appreciate appreciate your support very much, sir. So what's on your mind?
No, I was inquiring why you don't trust me just because I have a six-pack.
Whoa, hold on a second, Rob. Hold on. I didn't say that. I said that somebody who was a Marine said that to me when we were abroad. He was an older guy. He was in his 40s, and we were talking about PT, and he was like, I don't trust anybody ever 35 with a six-pack. He meant it in a humorous way, Pedro, or Rob.
No, it's true, and you know, I have a lot of Marine buddies, too. I'm ex-combat para. So, yeah,
oh, okay.
I get it, but the bottom line is, you know, if you study eating or food long enough, you understand that basically to get a six-pack, sometimes you don't even have to try. If you just eat the right way, and if you want your body to function on that level of like when you were 20, which is what I go for, it just happens automatically.
So give us some tips. Rob, I mean, you know, the men folk out there are like, let's do the six-pack thing.
Yeah, well, a couple tips, and I don't want to get above myself because, you know, I'm not a triple PhD or anything, but it is one of my passions. But, you know, I found that, generally speaking, a combination, like if you were to Venn diagram, a Paleolithic diet with a low glycemic diet with a low inflammation diet, you pretty much find your blueprint for a six-pack, if that's what you're going for. And definite, a sizable amount of muscle.
Okay. So I mean, work out, eat paleo slash low. I mean, when you mean glycemic, it's kind of for the lay person out there. You mean low sugar, right? I mean, essentially low glycemic index foods that can be converted into sugar. And what's a low inflammatory diet? People refer to me as being inflammatory sometimes, who are Democrats, but that's obviously not what we're talking about here.
Yeah. That's good. I mean, that's a good type of inflammation. I mean, there are good types of inflammation. Anyway, the low inflammation. There are certain foods that are naturally inflammatory that just for whatever reason, it's almost like we don't even know why. But inflammation is caused by, for instance, responses with your immune system, negative responses, almost like allergies. And so certain foods create or cause these responses in your body, which basically hurts you in the long term. And so you will have a low glycemic food potentially, like, for instance, I guess you could say something like a cut of red meat, we'll say, that's specifically fatty, might be low glycemic, but maybe pro-inflammatory.
Hmm. Okay.
And so, like, you know,
where do bacon cheeseburgers from Five Guys fall onto this list? Just so I know.
I would say if you took the bread out, I would say that it's low glycemic, but the bacon might be a problem. But like I said, a little inflammation is good. Like when you go to work out, you're causing a form of systemic inflammation, even though it's not having itself to do with allergies or anything like that, or autoimmune-wise. You're forming, you're continuing and producing inflammation, so that I guess later on, you know, you can break down muscle and obviously build muscle.
Okay.
You know, after you're done eating.
All right.
The right way.
So Five Guys, no bun, maybe not the worst thing in the world. I'll take that away from this. Rob, thank you for calling in from New Jersey.
Love
good to
you,
hear
man.
From you. Appreciate it. Thank you, man. Thanks for listening to the show. I really do appreciate it. See, we learn all kinds of new things here together on the show. A little bit of fitness expertise. Next thing you know, we're going to be talking about ways to make a lovely summer salad with goat cheese and strawberries. Ooh, yummy. We could do some of that if you want. I think we're busy with some. I know some of you are saying, no, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I wanted to move on to the L.A. minimum wage, by the way, which I think is pretty amazing. This has happened now. This is a thing. This is happening. I meant to get to it yesterday. Didn't really have that much time, and we'll continue on with this through the break. If you have thoughts on the L.A. minimum wage, by the way, call in. Tell me what you think. It's $15. $15 an hour by 2020. That's what they're saying. So they're raising it over a period of time, and then they're indexing it to inflation. Now, what's interesting to me is that this always seems to ignore, and this is one of these political arguments that is sort of immune to the numbers, the stats, and the reality of what happens, because we can think to ourselves, well, can't you just pay workers a little more? Don't workers need a little more? I mean, it does sort of pull on the, I guess you'd have to say, redistributionist or even socialist heartstrings that so many people have. Right. Which is not necessarily in all cases something that we would just reject out of hand. Right. I mean, you know, people do believe in, you know, you believe in homeless shelters. You believe in assistance to the poor and the needy and in different cases. And you believe that workers should have certain rights protected. Right. There's bans on exploitation and slavery and other things. But a $15 minimum wage. Let's talk about what that looks like in just a minute.
Buck Sexton. The Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton.
Just not a salad person, by the way. Something I guess I feel like it's important that we keep lines of communication here, not just open, but also very honest. I'm just never, to borrow from the great philosopher Ron Swanson, I don't like it when people bring me food that my food should be eating. And I just, a cold plate of greens just doesn't, I like vegetables. I just don't like salads, really. You know, and I think this, I don't know why we're sort of living in the tyranny of salad and bread. Why can't we be brought other things as just sort of it comes, you sit at a restaurant, they bring you bread, and a lot of what you order maybe will come with a salad. I don't know, why can't it come with like some polenta, or maybe a little bit of sweet potato fries or something? It has to come with a salad. Well, this may be why I don't have a six pack, but so this is something that I just want to be honest, but I just don't like salads. So nonetheless, where were we? We're talking about LA, minimum wage in LA, $15 minimum wage. So let's talk about this for a second, shall we? The idea that the minimum wage is going to benefit, and this is a debate that keeps happening, and the Democrats love it because it doesn't matter what the evidence says or what the studies of this show. People like the notion of a minimum wage. It's counterintuitive to think that a minimum wage is not helpful to people who are showing up, are doing a job, and could use a little more money in their pockets. And then they say that there's an effect of this getting spent, and so then that stimulates the economy, and then it's just a win-win-win all around. The only downside to it that the Democrats, the left, will accept on this issue is they'll say, well, yeah, it's a little less money out of the pockets of sort of the managerial and owner class, the bourgeoisie, as it would have been called in another context, and boo stinking who for them, right? That's the way this always breaks down. Now, what we end up finding out, though, is that there is a much more complicated picture from raising the minimum wage than what the first sort of run at this would give you. Part of it is that the issue for many people who are on minimum wage is not the wage, it's the number of hours they're given. This is also one of the very pernicious side effects of Obamacare. Once you reach a certain number of hours, you have to provide people with insurance under the employer mandate, which still hasn't gone into effect, by the way, because they can't hide from what that's going to do, right? They don't want people to realize what's happened with that. They want to make sure that we're just getting deeper into debt, bigger government, more status. People are more used to getting subsidized health care, more health care spending coming from the government. So by the time we figure out what the employer mandate's actually done, too late. We're going to be on our own. But we know that hours is a very important component of this whole process, and that if you can't get enough hours, you can't make enough income. And so what happens when you raise the minimum wage is for hourly employees, some businesses, particularly small businesses that have perhaps very thin margins and are just barely making a profit, people forget that if you're just barely making a profit to make a business, right? Like, you could own a business that's profitable. Let's say you run a store that's a dry cleaner, right? And the owner is pulling in $40,000 or $50,000 a year of this dry cleaner after all the everything that's been paid, after he's paid his employees and has paid the rent and everything else. So he's making, his take home is $40,000 or $50,000. Well, you could say that maybe this will only hurt his profit share by X amount of dollars, right? By making the minimum wage 15. By the way, that's a big jump. By the time this actually happens, assuming it happens, this will be a substantial jump. And that means that then there could be some real effect here. But let's say he goes from making, we'll call it $40,000 a year from owning this dry cleaning store after he's paid all of his employees and everything else. Or maybe let's call it 50. We'll say it's 50. And it drops down to 40 in terms of profit for him. Well, you could say, well, yeah, he's still making money. But the point is, well, is there a better way for him to make that money? Does he want to keep operating this business? Does he want to keep putting in the hours and doing this and trying to grow his business perhaps for this? There are probably easier ways for him to make that money. In fact, a minimum wage of $15 an hour, I believe, if you extrapolate that out and give someone a full work week, assuming there's a full work week that this entails, which of course is not always true, it's oftentimes not true, then you're making a pretty substantial income. You're making what I can tell you, first year CIA employees make. So that's, I think, one aspect of this that doesn't get enough attention. There will be businesses, some of the employees who are at businesses that can take this hit because they'll just pass the costs on to their customers, which, of course, then there's the issue of, well, is everyone paying more now? And how much money comes out of your pocket because of this? If you live in L.A. now, you're going to be paying, instead of paying $5 for a latte, you're going to be paying $7.50 for a latte. Well, that's in itself a form of sort of imposed cost on you, a tax on you that is not treated as such, but that's really what it is. It's not called that, but there's no difference in terms of the money out of your pocket. And so there's that aspect of this as well. And then, of course, there's going to be businesses where they lay off employees. So now you're just going to join the vast ranks of the completely unemployed, and not just unemployed, but those who are not even seeking to be employed anymore, who have just dropped out of the workforce entirely. In fact, I know there was, 40%, according to CNBC, 40% of the unemployed have stopped looking for jobs entirely. So there's a very large percentage, as these things go, as workforce participation rates are measured over a period of time, that they're not even trying to get a job anymore. They're like, I am donezo. What benefits can I get? Maybe I can go on disability. I'm sick of this. And when you look at the benefits being offered versus the labor that goes into a job and the possibility of making one's way up that ladder and the taxation one pays on income and all this other stuff, it starts to look like, for some, an increasingly rational decision. You know, why go through all the motions? Why go through all the noise and all the trouble if you can just sort of find another way to have it given to you? You know, it's for those of us who are working or those of us who are trying to hack it out somehow, there's this knee-jerk reaction that comes, and I understand where it comes from, to say, you know, hey, people shouldn't be doing that. But the government's the one making these rules, right? So it's not entirely, you can't entirely blame people for making decisions based upon the rules put in place by government about how much they pay in taxes and how stifling regulations are, how hard it is to start a small business. Now, I was speaking to a friend of mine just a few weeks ago about his small business that he operates here in New York. It's just, he says, the government loves to talk about, oh, we're doing this for small business and that for small business. All they do is just try to take more from you and make it harder. All they do is just make this process impossible, make it as likely as possible that you'll fail. Because they're not giving you any support. They're just taking all the time and telling you no. That's all they are. Give us more. No, you can't do that. That's the function of government here in New York State if you're a small business. You know, they talk about, oh, there's this program for small businesses. And you try to get, you know, maybe you get a little bit of tax relief or you get some sort of a benefit. No. Your business doesn't qualify for that. It's just a talking point that they use. So that's one aspect of this. And there's going to be a drop in some employment at some of these places that will happen. These are people that won't have jobs anymore. And then, of course, there's also just with all of it, there'll be businesses that go belly up because of this. And there's also this premise of why not, if you want to make this more philosophical, why not $50? Why stop at 15? Why not 25? Since we're spitballing here, I mean, you know, why not make every job the average income of a U.S. household such that everyone has to have the average? No one seems to realize that if you do that, guess what? That's not average anymore. Now you're just raising all incomes, which means that you're going to be creating all kinds of dislocations, and people who are making 45 or 48 grand or whatever the average household income is in this country aren't going to be, if every job starts there, is what I'm trying to say. If every single job in the country starts there, that's no longer going to be the average, right? So, and people think, well, that's a good thing. Well, if that's your position, why don't we just print $100,000 and give it and put it in a bank account for every American? Because that won't have any ill effects on the economy or anything else, right? Let's just give everybody $100,000. I could use $100,000. Trust me. Let's take a call from Joe in Vermont on minimum wage. Joe, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Shields high, Buck.
Shields high. What's up, Joe?
Not too much. Before I get into minimum wage, yes, you're right. Both David Letterman and Bruce Springsteen are wildly overrated.
Thank you. Speaking sense, my friend. Speaking some sense.
I try. I've told you before that I'm an accountant, and I also have owned and operated a business. So I've done a lot of payrolls. And you could spend a full week trying to bat down all the mischaracterizations, to be kind, that are propagated by, you know, people advocating minimum wage, talking about things like wage disparity and all those other things. It's a pretty complicated topic, but you know.
Cool. Well, can I ask you before you move on, Joe? Can you just remember where you want to go? But I just want to jump in to ask you something. So you're an accountant. I'm assuming you've worked with businesses. A lot. What would happen, you know, based on what you've seen? You've seen the numbers, obviously. A lot of businesses, assuming that Vermont, let's say, doubled the minimum wage, right? If they doubled the minimum wage tomorrow, what would happen to a lot of small businesses you've worked with?
Well, they'd be putting chains on their doors, or people would be fired, and the owners would just say, it's no longer worth it for me to hire these people to do this. I'll do it myself. Or they would increase the workload for their existing employees. They'd expect twice the production from, you know, whoever was on staff, and they would not get raises.
Right. So go ahead. Where did you want to go?
No, that's okay. That was an excellent question.
Why, thank you, sir. I try.
Yeah, you do a great job, Buck. You do a great job. If you have to pay someone $15 an hour, as an employer, that's probably, depending on the industry, probably costing you anywhere from 20 to 25 in cash out of pocket per hour to employ them. It depends on what your workers' comp rate is, because I owned a furniture moving company. Our workers' comp rate was really high, so that added about, you know, to a $10 wage, it added about $3 to $4 per hour to that wage that we had to pay out. And so there's that. There's the employer portion of Social Security. There's unemployment taxes. There are all these things. And in addition to that, in California, and you know, the business that I work for right now is centered in California, so we have a lot of California employees. There are many other ways in which the local and state government have their hands in your pocket, and it just goes up and up and up. It never goes down. So they're not only, you know, as you said, taking your money, they're taking your time, because there's a very high compliance burden that goes along with all this. And the thing is that, as you have mentioned many times before, when you wind up talking to people at the employment offices, at the tax offices, the interpretation of the statute is whatever they say it is at the time. You can call multiple times, you get a different answer from each person, and it really takes a lot of time to get, you know, any kind of question answered or just general.
Right. They are eating our substance, to borrow from the declaration. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes, exactly. So it's not easy. It's very complicated and expensive to employ people, and you know, this certainly isn't going to help. And you know, all the other laws that most people think are generally pretty good, I would have to say that they, you know, equal employment opportunity usually means no employment opportunity. You know, fair pay usually means no pay. All those things are the exact opposite of what the actual result winds up being. There's an awful lot of sand in the gears, and for, you know, younger people especially, I'm mature, I've been in the workforce for a long time, so I have worked through all those positions that were very low-paying, long hours, multiple jobs at one time, all that stuff, pretty, you know, a lot of times pretty unpleasant work too. But if the barrier...
We've got about 10 seconds here, my friend. Go ahead.
If the barrier to get even that kind of work is raised, then those people are not going to enter the workforce at all, and they may never be able to.
Right. Absolutely. Joe from Vermont, good to hear from you. Thanks for sharing some expertise. Team Buck, we got more coming. Back in just a minute.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network. Your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
Quick Team Buck reminder here. Tomorrow I'm in for Glenn from 9 to 12 Eastern Time. Let's take Larry in Washington. Larry, we got about a minute, but I want to bring you in. Go ahead.
Hey, Buck, Shields High, but anyway, in Washington...
Shields High? No, there's always time for Shields High. Go ahead, Larry.
We have our minimum wage tied to the cost of living, and if that's what they're also doing with the $15 an hour in L.A., by the end time it is enacted at 15 hours an hour, it will be actually more than that if you tie in the cost of living. Because when has the cost of living ever gone down in a socialist place like L.A.?
Yeah, no, I mean, look, L.A. is actually cheaper to live in than New York by a wide margin based upon real estate prices. But, yeah, that's just me whining about New York. That doesn't really mean anything, but I'm just saying. But yeah, of course, if they're tying it to cost of living, and then it turns into, you know, is everyone going to have sort of a minimum income? But if everyone has a minimum income, well, then all of a sudden that can't buy you the same in the marketplace, right? I mean, this is what there seems to be no understanding of supply and demand or cause and effect with a lot of these policies that the left wants to institute.
Well, it's all based on a lie from the beginning because, like I said, the cost of living's never gone down. So what are they going to end up actually having to pay?
Right. No, it sounds good. It gets votes, but in reality, it doesn't have the intended effect, and it has a lot of negative impacts that people don't talk about. Larry from Washington, good to hear from you, buddy. Thank you for calling in. Glad we could get you in. All right, so tomorrow, it'll be early for me, 9 Eastern, but the rest of you, I hope you join me then. I'll be on Twitter at Buck Sexton. Also go to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. I have a Throwback Thursday photo there for today already. I'm excited to join you for 3 hours tomorrow morning. And also tonight, of course, for an hour at 7 Eastern on the Blaze TV. No matter what happens between now and then, my friends, you know what your orders are. You know your mandate. Shields high.
Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.